This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Christian Camargo. Today on the program, we bring you a discussion that examines the human rights and humanitarian crisis that the Yemeni people are facing today as a result of the ongoing civil war in Yemen. At its root, the conflict, which erupted in 2015, pits the U.S. and Saudi-backed Yemeni government against the Houthi armed movement. Beyond taking a close look at the harsh realities Yemenis are facing today, the discussion also focuses on efforts underway to end the crisis. We hear from two voices on the forum today, Andrea Prasso and Scott Paul. Andrea Prasso is Deputy Washington Director at Human Rights Watch, an organization that investigates and reports on human rights abuses around the globe. Scott Paul is Humanitarian Policy Lead for Oxfam, a global anti-poverty organization. Today's forum was recorded on March 21st, 2019, and was co-sponsored by the Tanner Center for Human Rights. To begin the discussion, here's Scott Paul to provide some of the broader context to the situation on the ground today in Yemen.
Thanks very much. Thanks to the Hinckley Institute for having us here today, and to the university. I want to take a minute to introduce Oxfam, the organization I work for, and the work that we're doing in Yemen, and then talk a little bit about why Yemen is in humanitarian crisis and what we can do about it. Oxfam is an international humanitarian and development organization. We like to say that we fight the injustice of poverty, and that means we don't see poverty or suffering in humanitarian crises as an issue of resource allocation. It's an issue of justice and power, and that's how we address all of the long-term poverty issues and humanitarian crises where we work. In Yemen, Oxfam has been working for more than 35 years, largely focused on the rights of women and youth and their role in the political process. Yemen is, as many of you I'm sure have read, now the world's largest humanitarian crisis. In a country of 29 million people, 24 million people need some form of humanitarian assistance. About 15.9 million people don't know how they'll get their next meal. Save the Children, one of our peer organizations, estimates that 85,000 children have already died because of the conflict. And the thing to bear in mind through all of this is that none of those deaths, none of the people in need, are in crisis because of any natural hazard. This is not because of an earthquake or a typhoon or a landslide or anything outside of the control of human beings. The need in Yemen boils down to there is a war and the people fighting it don't care enough to help people survive. In very, very broad terms, the war in Yemen is a conflict between Yemeni parties first and foremost. It arises out of a long history of tension within Yemen, culminating in a revolution in 2011 and 2012, which saw the former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, ousted from power. There was a national dialogue conference and a transitional process aimed to set Yemen on the course towards democracy. That process fell by the wayside. And the Houthis, a group that were founded as a religious revival and education movement in the north of Yemen, took their grievances outside the political process, captured the capital city of Sana'a, and forced Yemen's interim president into exile. Nearly 4 years from today, actually on March 25th, that's this coming Monday, that'll mark the fourth year anniversary of the intervention by a coalition of countries led by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to restore interim President Hadi to power. And that coalition was supported by many countries, including the United States, through different kinds of defense assistance and arms sales. So what I've just tried to do is just lay out in general how the conflict is being fought, by whom, over what time period, and given you a sense of the numbers of the humanitarian crisis. But I want to try and break down in a bit more detail why people are suffering. And as in any complex crisis, it's a lot of interlinking factors that are difficult to keep straight, and so I've developed a shorthand. The shorthand I call the four I's. There are four words that begin with I, And if you understand them and bear them in mind and think about them, you'll probably be able to understand most of why people are suffering. So the first of the four I words is inequality. Inequality is Yemen's baseline condition. Yemen is a poor country, but its poverty at the national level masks the fact that there are a small group of people in Yemen who have gotten extraordinarily wealthy based on years of corruption and siphoning off natural resource wealth and state revenues, while the vast majority of the population lives in acute poverty. And one group of Yemenis, about 15 or 20% of Yemenis, are regarded as perpetually displaced and segregated in a very rigid caste system. So if you're living in Yemen right now and you're not part of the ultra elite, then you're hurting. And if you're in that bottom half, you're fighting for your life. And if you're in that bottom 15 and 20%, you've been fighting for your life since before the conflict began, and now every day is a struggle. So that's inequality. The second I word is institutions. Here I'm talking partly about Yemen's private sector institutions, its companies that have suffered greatly, but even more about its public sector institutions. Yemen's government was always underdeveloped in terms of the provision of public services, but for 2.5 years, most civil servants have not been paid their salaries. And what that means is, first, people aren't getting the services they need to survive from government: health, education, sanitation, things like that. And secondly, 1.5 million people aren't getting the income that they were counting on. And so that 1.5 million people supports about 6 million people, 7 million people. So it's fair to say that about a quarter of all Yemenis relied on public sector salaries, government salaries, and now aren't receiving them. So that's institutions. The third is imports. Yemen is an incredibly import-dependent country. Even before the conflict, it depended on imports to meet about half of its, about half its fuel needs and the vast majority of its food needs. And what's happened over the past 4 years is that the Saudi-led coalition has set up what we call a de facto blockade. At times, that's taken the form of a total embargo of any goods coming in and out of Yemen's ports. For most of that time, it's been comprised of a set of arbitrary restrictions that have together had the effect of delaying entry of critical goods into the country through Yemen's seaports. And what that's done is it's massively inflated the costs of shipping to Yemen. And that, in turn, has massively inflated both the costs of basic household commodities, like food and fuel, and also severely damaged the economy. So that's imports. The last of the four I words is infrastructure. When I say infrastructure, I don't just mean roads and bridges, but I mean roads and bridges too. But I also mean, I mean schools, I mean hospitals, I mean ports. I mentioned already the private sector infrastructure, big factories and plants that employ a lot of people and produce goods for the Yemeni economy. This infrastructure has been devastated by the conflict. And Saudi and Emirati-led coalition airstrikes, supported by the United States, are responsible for the majority of that destruction. More than half of Yemen's health facilities have been either damaged or destroyed. And so in an environment where already people are poor, people can't afford food, people can't afford or access clean water or sanitation services, there are a lot of health needs. And when the basic health infrastructure doesn't hold up because the buildings are damaged or because the staff aren't being paid, a lot of basic conditions can become deadly. So I've spent, I've gone to Yemen roughly about every 6 months over the past couple of years. I've had an opportunity to talk to many, many people. when people in the United States are exposed to the conflict in Yemen, it's either through a news story that reduces the conflict to a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which it's not. We can talk more about that later. Or you see a picture of a 4 or 5 year old child dying in a hospital from malnutrition related illness. It's so important for people to see those pictures. It's equally important for people to imagine the context in which that child is living. Because too often, humanitarian emergencies in the US paint people who are dying as victims without choices. People always have choices. The problem is, in places like Yemen, the choices are absolutely heartbreaking. So if you see a child who is suffering from malnutrition, acute malnutrition, skin and bones, imagine that that child is being surrounded by not just physicians, but her parents. And for her parents to be there, they will have had to decide to spend the very last money that they have transporting their child 3 villages over to get to that clinic. And in doing so, they're losing opportunities to make money on those days. And they're putting the rest of their family at risk. Meanwhile, they probably have other sons and daughters. Yemeni families are large. So imagine they have sons, 8, 10, 13 years old. Those families are having discussions with their sons about whether they should be fighting in the war. Not because they care about any of the parties, but because fighting is one of the only ways to earn a reliable income. Or if they have daughters, they're having discussions about whether those daughters should be married. Early marriage has been a real challenge in Yemen for a long time, but it was on the decline leading up to the conflict. Now it is escalating beyond imagination. And we've met with families who have consented to have their daughters married at an age as early as 3 years old. Now, because child marriage is a traditional practice in Yemen, some of that would happen anyway, not at age 3, but age 13, 14, 15. But we're talking to families now who don't want that for their daughters, who are saying, I wanted my daughter to be financially independent, I wanted my daughter to be educated, but if I didn't accept this marriage proposal from my daughter, she probably would have died, and so would my other children. So every time we see a picture of that Yemeni child in the newspaper with a drip and suffering from acute malnutrition, fighting for her life, let's just remember what's surrounding that person. In those trips to Yemen, I've always asked the question, what is the message that you want to take to your elected officials? And without fail, it's really remarkable. I was just saying to Andrea earlier, there are statistical anomalies in almost every poll where someone says something different. Every single person I've talked to, probably about 30 individual interviews and about 200 people in bigger groups, you say, what is the message you want to pass on? The message is, end the war. End the war. And ending the war doesn't mean, to them, just stop the bombs. It means, yeah, stop the airstrikes. It means stop the laying of landmines, stop the shelling. But when I've asked what that means, they also say, it means I want to be able to go home so I can get a job. I want inflation to go down so that the money I do have can actually buy something. I want prices to stabilize. So that's why Andrea and I are working together so closely, and we're working and we're here and trying to spread the message about the crisis in Yemen, is because the United States has such an extraordinary amount of leverage that it refuses to use in the conflict, because throughout the past 4 years, U.S. policy in Yemen has been defined not by what's good for Yemenis, but what's good for Saudis and what's good for Emiratis and what's bad for Iran. Or I should say, what some people want to say is bad for Iran. In point of fact, Iran has gained immeasurable influence over the past 4 years. But a policy of unconditional and indefinite support to the Saudi and Emirati-led coalition has been a rhetorical tool, among other things, to demonstrate that first the Obama administration and now the Trump administration is tough on Iran. We can talk a bit more later about specifically what we can do, what Congress can do to push back against that policy. But there is a lot. But I think I should leave it there and pass things over to Andrea.
That's Scott Paul, a humanitarian policy lead for Oxfam. And you were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. On this program, as you might already know, we record and broadcast some engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. We replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. And today we are airing a forum examining the human rights and humanitarian crisis happening in Yemen. Speaking next is Andrea Prasso, Deputy Washington Director at Human Rights Watch.
I'm not going to talk about ending the war, although I think it should end. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about Human Rights Watch first and help explain why that's not what I'm going to focus on. Human Rights Watch is a non-governmental organization. We have around 450 people worldwide. We cover 90 countries with a physical presence in about 45 countries. That means some of our researchers cover two or three countries in a particular region. But we document human rights violations around the world, and we document violations of international law, whether it's international human rights law or the international laws that apply to armed conflict, that apply to war. So the reason I'm not going to talk about ending the war is that one of the things we do at Human Rights Watch is we talk about how to engage in war lawfully. That means we look at the conduct of all parties, whether it's a rebel group, whether it's a large state actor. When we look at human rights abuses, we also look at quasi-state actors. So we do make recommendations to large organizations like the World Bank or to mining companies that in certain areas operate essentially as a state actor. They have physical control over regions. So we look at international law and we look at who is in charge of compliance with those laws. And I think you guys saw some out here, this Universal Declaration of Human Rights. There's a basket of those out there. This is one of many international laws and treaties that we examine. And then what my job is in Washington is to take all of that and try to have it make sense to policymakers, which is a challenge, I'll tell you. So we have people who've been documenting human rights violations in Yemen for many, many years. In fact, we had a project we were just starting on child marriage right before the war, which we had to put aside because of much more pressing issues. So throughout the conflict, what we have documented are human rights violations and largely violations of the laws of war of international humanitarian law. These are the rules that govern the conduct of parties, rules that talk about what and who can be targeted. So civilians can't be targeted, something you're all familiar with. Unfortunately, it is often lawful for civilians to be killed in an armed conflict. But they can't be targeted. So warring parties can't bomb schools. They can't bomb hospitals. They can't not bother to find out who's in a particular building and just drop a bomb or assume one fighter is in there so it doesn't matter that there are 30 civilians inside a building as well. So what we've done over the course of the conflict is we've documented those violations. We've documented many, many violations by the coalition engaged in the air war, which is led by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. We've also documented violations by the Houthis, the other parties. And we've documented human rights violations in detention, again, by all parties to the conflict. So we've documented torture in detention by UAE-backed forces and by Houthi forces. I think it's really important to note, although it's a small segment of what's happening in Yemen, is that we and the Associated Press have both documented the presence of U.S. personnel in detention centers where there are very credible allegations of torture. The U.S. government has denied this, but we have credible allegations that Defense Department personnel were present and aware of detainees being tortured. So again, we take that research and we take it to policymakers and we seek change. And over the course of the conflict, we've taken a number of steps which we haven't in other situations because of the U.S. government role and because of the U.S. government intransigence. So from the beginning of the conflict, the U.S. government was heavily involved in supporting the Saudi-led coalition through mid-air refueling of Saudi aircraft, by providing targeting information, by being physically present inside the operations command centers where decisions were being made about which targets to engage in, and by providing intelligence information that was then used by the Saudis and other coalition members to select targets. The U.S. was also heavily involved in trying to develop an accountability mechanism for the coalition. Now, this is a good thing. We believe in accountability at Human Rights Watch. We were supportive of the effort. The State Department spent a great deal of time sending people to Riyadh to develop an accountability mechanism. Unfortunately, we ultimately put out a report about how inadequate that accountability mechanism has been. Because one of the key takeaways for us over the course of the conflict has been that we've documented violations of the laws of war. So either the deliberate or reckless killing of civilians or similar actions like that. And then we've seen no responsibility taken by the actors. Mistakes do happen in war. And what we expect from states and from all parties to a conflict is some kind of apology and some kind of redress. And in fact, international law provides, in some cases, requires redress. In other instances, it's just very good policy. It used to be routine U.S. policy in Afghanistan and in Iraq that when civilians were harmed, either killed or their property was damaged, uniformed U.S. personnel would go out to the family or to surviving victims and provide some form of compensation and an apology. Not a lot, but just something to say, a terrible thing happened. We're really sorry. Here's a little bit that will help you rebuild. We do not see that happening in Yemen. We are aware of probably a handful of forms of payment to survivors of strikes that are done not publicly without any formal acknowledgement. But overall, what we've seen is denial. Denial by the coalition that civilians were harmed, denial of which country was involved in a particular strike. In fact, our report, the subtitled report, was hiding behind the coalition. So the coalition would acknowledge that the coalition conducted a strike, but never identify which country flew the strike, who provided the intelligence information, and so on. And this mechanism that the U.S. tried to support and sort of built for the Saudis and for the coalition has really served as a way of whitewashing the civilian harm. Instead of providing accountability, it has let the coalition say to the international community, look, we're taking responsibility. We have this mechanism. We do investigations. But in fact, they don't actually provide any form of redress for the victims. And in particular, what we haven't seen is a change in conduct based on an assessment of what went wrong. The number one reason that militaries do what are called after-action reports or similar investigations after something happens is to find out what went wrong, why, and take steps to correct it. And again, time and time again, even if there is some minimal acknowledgement, and there has been in some cases, of violations, we've not seen steps taken to correct it, which suggests that the Saudis and the other coalition members are not very interested in changing their conduct. And I think that's true. I don't think they're interested in changing their conduct. And I think one of the reasons they're not interested is because they don't get any real international opposition. They certainly don't get opposition from the United States. Now, recently, the U.S. did decide to end mid-air refueling of Saudi aircraft, which is something that we supported. And I think it was actually necessary to avoid U.S. legal liability for some of the violations of the laws of war that we documented. But the U.S. continues to support Saudi Arabia in particular, as well as the UAE, and continues to support it not just by selling weapons, but provides really a significant amount of moral support. The president has been very clear that Saudi Arabia is a strong ally, which is fine. I don't have an issue with that. But has essentially said that the Saudis can't do anything to change U.S. support. It does not matter what they do, to the point that many of you we're familiar with in the fall, the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, killing and brutal dismemberment by the Saudi regime. And the response from the U.S. government has been extremely muted. Some people were sanctioned under the Global Magnitsky Act, which allows the U.S. government to impose visa bans and asset freezes on persons responsible for gross violations of human rights. But the White House has been extremely clear that it will not look higher up to hold people responsible who should be, in particular Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is likely responsible for ordering and authorizing that killing. Similarly with Yemen, President Trump has been very clear that he will continue to support the Saudi Crown Prince in his campaign in Yemen. This has allowed the Saudis to really feel that they don't have to answer to the international community. And that has led to resistance in engaging in peace talks, something we don't take a particular position on, but it's quite clear that as much as we don't call for peace, peace is the only thing that is going to change the situation in Yemen. If this conflict continues, the civilians will continue to bear the brunt of it. And in the meantime, the utter lack of accountability means that one day when there is some kind of resolution, it's not clear what will be left for people to rebuild. If there's no system of accountability, there's no system of justice, then even if the day-to-day fighting is diminished, it will be very difficult for the Yemeni people to really rebuild their lives and to come to terms with how to move forward as a united people following this kind of conflict. And that's something that, unfortunately, we've seen around the world. If countries don't deal with the justice issues and don't deal with accountability, then these problems remain and they resurface 2 years, 5 years, 10 years down the road. And Scott and I were talking about South Sudan earlier, and I remember being there a few years ago and people saying to me, right there, that's where they killed so-and-so 30 years ago. And they were talking about a new conflict, but they were remembering what happened 30 years ago, and it was still live in their minds. And I fear that if people are not truly held to account for the violations in Yemen now, that we will be hearing these stories 30 years from now. That was a depressing summary, but I wanted to keep it brief, and I'll let Scott have a chance to respond to some of the things I've said too, and then we really wanted to open this up for discussion and hear from all of you.
Yeah, and actually more than respond, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk a bit about Congress's role over the past few years. So rather than respond, I'm just going to quickly walk us through that because it's been so important. And just to sort of, so you can track what Congress has done with the external political context. President Obama supported a decision to support the Saudi-led coalition when it began its intervention in March of 2015. And over the course of the next 2 years, that was, the last 2 years of President Obama's term was essentially a learning curve in how to influence the parties to this conflict. And over those 2 years, they realized that being a part of the coalition or supportive of the coalition and quietly advocating behind the scenes was not changing behavior. And then they started to see some returns when they became more vocal and actually shifted policy to create leverage with the coalition. Then President Trump came in and everything went back to zero. President Trump and his administration said, we don't know the Saudis or the Emiratis, we need to get to know them, and they are strategic partners. And actually, over the past couple of years, the attitude from the Trump administration has not been one in which they've learned the limits of their influence. It's actually one in which they've sacrificed the leverage that they could have, because it's just become clearer and clearer that standing side by side with Gulf partners to sell arms and to demonstrate a united front and tough talk against Iran is more important to this administration than anything that happens inside Yemen. And so in parallel with that, Congress has become gradually more and more assertive over the past 4 years. It was in 2016 that there was the first time there was any real effort to oppose a sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia. The end of last year, a resolution that Senator Mike Lee from Utah, together with Senator Bernie Sanders, introduced to end the sort of the physical role of the United States in the conflict, which at that point, since refueling had ended, amounted to advisors contributing to targeting assistance and target selection in a joint operations cell. So their resolution said that was unauthorized by Congress and therefore unconstitutional. The Senate adopted it last year. Now the House and Senate have both adopted something similar, and for procedural reasons, it'll have to go back to the House. Meanwhile, the conversation around the sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia and the UAE has continued. And the most significant piece of legislation that's currently in play at the moment is a piece of legislation, bipartisan legislation, that deals with the war in Yemen and the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi in a single piece of legislation. And that's a bill authored by Todd Young, a Republican from Indiana, and Bob Menendez, the ranking member of the Foreign Relations Committee in New Jersey, and supported by some very senior national security leaders in both parties. The Yemen part of it, which is the part that Oxfam cares about, is important because, for one thing, it doesn't aim just to blame the Saudis, but it does acknowledge that arms sales to Saudi Arabia are a key component of U.S. leverage in the conflict. So it would unconditionally suspend the sale of bombs, and then it would conditionally tie the sale of other offensive weapons to a set of developments and behaviors by Saudi Arabia and by other parties to the conflict. So it really lays out what Congress wants to see. And a lot of that has to do with progress towards a political settlement of the conflict and access for commercial suppliers and humanitarian organizations like Oxfam. So that might actually be a bit more in the weeds than we needed to go, but I wanted to make sure that everyone here appreciated, first of all, just how much Congress has already been doing, and second of all, how important it is both that Senator Lee and Senator Romney appreciate that this is not only a critically important human rights issue and humanitarian issue in general, but one in which the United States is poised to achieve a lot of impact through what they do.
That's Scott Paul, a humanitarian policy lead for Oxfam. And you were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is a Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. If you're just joining us, today on the program we feature a forum taking a look at the human rights and humanitarian crisis in Yemen. In this final segment, panel members take questions from the audience of faculty and students.
First of all, thank you both for being here. So you brought up sort of international opposition. So we've talked a little bit how like a state actor like the United States and how Congress can sort of have some leeway and change. But how does the international community condemn, or like how does that work in a case like Yemen?
So the U.S. is not the only state that feels that its strategic alliance with Saudi Arabia is paramount. The U.K. and France have continued to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and we've made calls for those governments to stop weapon sales as well. But other states have responded more in substance than the U.S. has. And the U.S. is really the only country that's had this sort of unequivocal support, this rhetorical, you know, we will stand by you no matter what response, which is why it is somewhat different. But it does not mean that it's our only target in terms of trying to shift policy towards Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
So from a non-legal perspective, and in terms of the politics of the conflict and the role of the international community, one of the most important and detrimental turning points took place in April 2015, and that was the UN Security Council adoption of its Resolution 2216. What Resolution 2216 basically said was that the coalition intervention was legitimate, and that the Houthis were required to withdraw from major cities, cease exercising government functions, release political prisoners, unilaterally disarm. All issues that would have been key demands of the coalition and the government, and frankly, requirements for any political settlement in any conflict where there's an insurgency and an internationally recognized government. But by putting that down as the requirements up front for the peace process, it essentially created an attempt at political resolution that was doomed from the start. Because on one side, the government and the coalition would say, well, we'll engage in the process, but it has to begin and end with the unconditional surrender of the other party. And meanwhile, the Houthis looked at it and said, well, that doesn't look like that has anything for us at all. So we're going to keep fighting. So when you see groups like Oxfam push on the U.S. government's support of the coalition, it's not because the Houthis are right and the coalition is wrong. It's because the negotiations aren't working because the international community is both calling for peace and defeat of one party at the same time. And that's never going to work.
So you briefly mentioned like sort of like illegitimate or like unacknowledged United States involvement. So I think a lot of us started to hear about Yemen through like drone strikes and kind of like a war on terror sort of context back in the Obama administration. Sort of there's like a war on terror, there's American contractors. So like, do you still see American contractors operating in Yemen? And is that legal? Is that like, what's the context there, I guess?
Yeah, that's a really good question and difficult to answer. So first of all, the U.S. conflict with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen has not ended. The U.S. continues to conduct drone strikes against AQAP in Yemen. It's in a different geographic area than most of the fighting that we're talking about. And the volume is just so much smaller compared to the conflict that's why that's primarily people talk about the war. Or that war. but that is still happening. Although one of the things that happened, one of the reasons that there are fewer drone strikes in Yemen now is that the U.S. has no ground presence. And the nature of the war has meant that the political motivation behind any intelligence that the U.S. may obtain is questionable. There's just no reason to think that any information the U.S. gathers is going to be accurate about whom to target. So I know that was a concern at the start of the conflict, and I can only imagine that it has been exacerbated because there are such complex motivations. I mean, people being detained in the conflict are detained primarily for political reasons. People are not captured for committing criminal violations or violations of the laws of war. They're detained purely for political reasons or purely because they're related to someone whom one of the parties wants to detain for political reasons. And they'll be very explicit, you know, when your uncle shows up, we'll let you go. Things like that. So the conflict is quite complicated in that sense. U.S. Americans who had been contractors or had previously worked for the U.S. military are alleged to have played a significant role in a variety of actions in Yemen. I don't think anyone is on the ground. I don't know if you know others. There just aren't.
I've heard reports that there are contractors working in Mukalla with the UAE.
Yeah, there may be a little bit, not on the ground. But I don't know to what extent they're involved in training. And there have been allegations of connections to detention as well. So it's still a pretty murky area. It's still an area that really would benefit from greater transparency from the U.S. government and from all parties.
I don't have anything additional in response to your question, but something Andrea said made me realize there's a really key point that I also needed to make. Andrea mentioned that there's a number of different wars happening inside Yemen, which is really important. And the people who I talk to who are demanding peace, like I said, for them that means we want to be safe from airstrikes, landmines, shelling. We want prices to go down. We want our money to be worth something. We want jobs. They don't mean we want no fighting in Yemen anymore, because that is a long, long, long way off. I just think it's really important to make the point when people ask, when will Yemen have peace? No one knows the answer to that question, because in that broad sense, Yemen has not had peace for a very long time. And the parties who are fighting in the current conflicts will immediately, because the conflicts have become so fragmented, they will turn against one another once there is a political settlement between the Saudi Arabia-led coalition with the UAE and the Houthis and the government of Yemen. But that's not to downplay the importance of that settlement, because it's between those parties that a lot of the agreements can be found that will fix the economy and will ultimately rescue millions of people from humanitarian crisis. So there won't be peace for a long time, but the track of political conversations taking place now is still incredibly important.
You mentioned an attempted accountability mechanism for the coalition, and I was wondering if you think any more attempts in the future will come to fruition, or what different parties should consider, or if you think any international organizations could potentially hold the coalition accountable.
Yeah, there are a range of options. So I should have mentioned, too, that the UN Human Rights Council has implemented an investigative mechanism and twice authorized investigations into the violations in Yemen. So there is some documentation there. The accountability mechanism I was referring to is called the JIAT, the Joint Incidents Assessment Team. And it's a coalition mechanism that is supposed to assess incidents that occur in the course of the conflict. It has done so on a number of occasions. It does not make its findings public. It has made its findings public on a periodic basis tied to a political event. So when the UN is examining whether it should renew the mandate, suddenly the JIAT released a bunch of reports. Sort of pockets of reports were released that way. And we have, our researchers have come through them and tried to sort of analyze them in a comprehensive way, but it's not like going to a court docket and sort of reading the cases. And then when they have done investigations, they have generally absolved themselves of any liability. They have often said that, you know, civilians were not harmed when we've documented civilian harm and so on. So the mechanism itself is not working. It doesn't mean that it couldn't. If there were political will, then absolutely these incidents could be investigated. It's not a secret when there's a strike. I mean, you know, something happens from the air, a village is decimated or whatever, car is blown up, there are witnesses, there is signals intelligence that can be used, there are flight recorders, you know, there's a lot of information for these. And then there has to be the political will to do it, to hold people to account, and to be prepared to provide some kind of redress, some way of helping people rebuild their lives. And I think the international community absolutely plays a role in really pressuring the coalition to do so. And then there are other forms of accountability. So I mentioned the Global Magnitsky Act, which is a US law that allows the impositions of sanctions. We have formally called for UN Security Council sanctions to be applied to people responsible that we've detailed in this in our report on the JIAT. And we have, and would make the same call for Global Magnitsky. We haven't done that formally yet, but we're planning to. Again, to say the US has this capacity to sanction human rights abusers. We've documented human rights abuse, failure to take action. So people should be sanctioned. One of the limitations of sanctions, of course, is that, first of all, sanctions are designed to change future conduct. So they're not designed to be sort of criminally punitive. And second, in order for sanctions to work, the sanctioned person has to have funds that can be frozen or a desire to go to the country that is going to ban them from entering, right? So if all of your money is in Saudi Arabia and you never want to go to the US, then US imposed sanctions are pretty irrelevant. Which is one of the reasons sanctions usually only matter if they go pretty high up the chain of command, because with human rights abusers around the world, you find people who want to fly to London and go shopping or send their kids to American schools and so on. So you usually have to go pretty high up the chain to have sanctions be some hurt people in some fashion, enough to ideally make them stop and reconsider the action that they're doing and change in the future. I don't think sanctions are the solution to the lack of accountability in Yemen, but I think they would help let the Saudis and the Emiratis know that the international community is really taking this seriously and expects to see more action.
Thank you so much, both of you, for being here. I'm wondering, what is the military-civilian relationship in Yemen? If the military were to be part of an aid distribution system, would they be trusted? I mean, how do the civilians feel about all of the different militaries, and what does that look like on the ground?
So generally speaking, this won't surprise you coming from an aid agency, but the aid agency view is that the aid agency should deliver the relief whenever we can. It's only in very exceptional circumstances where the military has an important role to play in relief operations. And usually that's in very, very large scale, rapid onset disasters. And the reason is because the military has an unparalleled logistical capability. They can move stuff and people faster than 30 Oxfams with all of their resources and logistical experts combined. So we've seen that, for example, for the earthquake in Haiti. The military played an incredibly important role. They have a floating hospital they take down there. It lets you scale up really, really quickly. But in general, our view in most crises, and especially in crises that are heavily politicized, armed conflicts, is that the farther away militaries are from aid, the better. And the reason is that essentially, as soon as aid becomes associated with one military actor, everyone delivering humanitarian assistance anywhere in the area becomes associated with that actor. So it endangers everybody. That's on top of the fact that for most things that aid agencies do, aid agencies are better at it than the military. We're better at monitoring and evaluating our results. We're better and learning from our mistakes. We're better at targeting the most vulnerable people, identifying them to become beneficiaries. We're better at certain infrastructure projects. Military is better at other certain very rapid, large-scale infrastructure projects. But the most important thing is just when aid becomes politicized, not only does it become less effective, but it puts the rest of the aid community at risk. And so the most direct response to your question is there's no military that will be trusted by everyone, and some militaries that will be trusted by no one as deliverers of impartial and independent humanitarian assistance.
Thank you very much for coming today. I have a question. Senator Mike Lee, has he expressed there's something that tugged at his heartstrings, or how was the information presented to him, and how can we go forward with that type of action?
Well, Senator Lee first began working and leading this effort on the War Powers Resolution, I think out of a conviction less to do with Yemen specifically, but more to do with the fact that, in his view, the executive branch of government was wielding the power to authorize force in a way that wasn't consistent with the Constitution. The Constitution commits the power to declare war to the legislative branch, and through a very, very, very long period of time, that power has become sort of slowly it's diminished over time. And so for him, using the War Powers Resolution to declare this particular use of force as unconstitutional is his way of claiming some of that power back. That being said, when he's taken the Senate floor to talk about the War Powers Resolution, he's been extremely compelling about the ill-considered nature of this particular use of force and U.S. involvement in this particular conflict, both in strategic terms and in human terms. And so we've also seen him oppose arms sales to Saudi Arabia, presumably on similar grounds. In case we don't get an opportunity to conclude more generally, I do want to leave you with this idea, and this is for anyone joining on the radio as well. Senator Lee, and yeah, we'll come back. Did you have another question?
No.
Oh, sorry. I saw you raising your hand. Senator Lee has done a really important service by raising U.S. involvement in this conflict. There is so much more that needs to be done. On the day, I think I mentioned this, but I'll just say it again because it bears repeating. On the day that the Senate voted to adopt Senator Lee's War Powers Resolution for Yemen, last December, it was the same day that the parties to the conflict signed an agreement to de-escalate fighting around Yemen's most important port. That was not a coincidence. That is a very clear manifestation of the leverage that the United States has in this conflict that it is not using. There is a lot more that can be done. Senator Lee needs to, we hope, continue the fight that he started. And we would love to see Senator Romney, who is now the chair of the Middle East subcommittee in the Senate, take a leadership role and really define his alternative view of what U.S. engagement in the world ought to look like, rooted in human rights, rooted in the idea that U.S. involvement in the world can be positive sum, not just zero sum. We don't only win when others lose. Yemen is a great test case to see whether there is going to be an alternative view to the Trump administration when it comes to put it really bluntly, whether people's lives matter. outside of geopolitical terms for the U.S. So we hope to see that kind of resolve from Senator Romney and Senator Lee in the future.
Hi, my name is Ginger Phillips. Thank you very much for everything I learned today. First of all, it was like really surprising when you said Senator Lee and Bernie Sanders, like they're like, you know, on each side. I was just wondering, like, on continuation of what she asked, is how did they link up, and do they, like, since it's like an extreme, you know, whatever. I was just wondering how they got together and if they have different points of view, if they're bringing a different conversation together. And then my other question is, how would somebody get involved with doing some lobbying with the Human Rights Watch?
Well, for Human Rights Watch, we are less of a grassroots organization than some. I don't know if you have an Amnesty International chapter here, but there are a lot of human rights organizations that are really focused on individual membership. We have not been doing that traditionally, but we're doing more of it, and we're doing more digital campaigns. So you can read about all of our work on our website, which is hrw.org. So please do check it out. You can sign up for, we have a daily brief, which will sort of hit top human rights related news, different email actions, and so on. So please do check that out. And all of our work on Yemen is there. You know, all of our, we publish everything that we do on our website, along with their short videos, their, you know, different graphic novel explainers. You don't need to read it. I didn't bring any of our 100-page reports with me. You don't need to read them. But if you're writing a paper, you should read all of them. They're very helpful. In terms of the Sanders-Lee collaboration, I think, I can't speak to their personal motivations, but I think that we are finally, you know, nearly 4 years into this conflict, reaching a point where people are prepared to talk about Yemen and prepared to talk about Saudi Arabia on not a bipartisan basis, but a nonpartisan basis. This should not be about politics. And the details of the War Powers Resolution are, it's kind of complicated, but it makes sense why each of those men would be interested in it and asserting Congress's role. But what we've seen, interestingly, is that at the outset of these conversations, a lot of them would be about Congress's role, war powers, and less about Yemen. And this latest vote, it was all about Yemen. The vehicle was this sort of logistical, somewhat esoteric piece of U.S. law. But the reason that members were standing up was to talk about what was happening in Yemen. And I think that's what's really, really important. The humanitarian crisis is overwhelming, and that's mostly what people talk about. But I think in particular, since the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, many members of Congress have been concerned about the U.S., the unequivocal U.S. support for Saudi Arabia, whether it was in the conflict in Yemen or virtual silence on their human rights record and so on. So I think we've seen people prepared to stand up and think a little bit more independently and speak out more independently when setting politics aside. Now, it's Congress. We're from Washington. Politics will always come back in, even if there's a pause for a little while. But there are a lot of members of Congress who really value working with members from other political parties. And they see that the U.S. is strongest when issues like humanitarian aid or stopping human rights violations are something that the U.S. can really hold on to as part of its core foreign policy. And a lot of members of Congress have, and increasingly, I think, are rejecting the Trump administration's view, which is that foreign policy and human rights are transactional. Human rights will be discussed as a weapon against our enemies and ignored if it's about our allies. And we've seen, you know, there's explicit writing from senior advisors in the State Department saying, that's how to use human rights. Bring it up with China, bring it up with Russia, don't bring it up with Saudi Arabia. And I think most of Congress rejects that. And I think some of it is the wave of progressives that were elected at the midterms, but a lot of it is just members of Congress who say, that's not why I came to Washington. I came here to represent the views of my constituents, which include an understanding of what it means to be an American. And Americans don't engage this way. American foreign policy is supposed to be about protecting people, not hurting them.
That's Andrea Prasso of Human Rights Watch speaking at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on March 21st, 2019. If you would like to hear the full discussion, as well as other Hinckley forums, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org. Today's forum was co-sponsored by the Tanner Center for Human Rights, and this program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Christian Camargo, producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.